And I have a great guest tonight, and I'm going to get to him right now. He was on last week, and this is Gilbert Erickson. I asked Gilbert to come back. If you listened to the show last week, I asked him to come back because he was talking about Planet X along with John DiNardo, and both of their input was vital. But the thing with Gil is he talks about, through his book, and I advise you to get this book because I have read it. It's a terrific book. It's The Millennium Prophecy. And you know what? You can get it through www.millenniumprophecy.com. You could buy it as an ebook. You can get it as hard copy. But Mr. Erickson has managed to talk about wormwood in light of a biblical prophecy in the book of Revelation, and he goes through all the judgments. Well, perhaps one of the most confusing things about Revelation, even though I think I've read the entire Bible six times in the last maybe 15, 16 years, and Revelation is my favorite part because part of my doctorate's in eschatology. But, you know, when you start talking about all those seals and trumpets and these judgments, they get very confusing. But Gil's managed to put it all together in a way that's very understandable. And we're going to talk about that tonight. We're going to go through each seal that Christ breaks, the Lamb breaks, and we're going to talk about what that seal means. And we're also going to talk about how wormwood fits into that, because wormwood is really already into effect. And wormwood is this large planet or star, a brown dwarf star. They don't know which one it really is. That is supposedly going to affect the poles and magnetic fields and gravitational forces, et cetera, which Gil will explain, and has already done so. But by 2012, that's when it's supposed to have the most dynamic effect on us, and not all of it is good. So let me just give you a brief intro on him this week, because I did do this last week, and I don't want to eat up a whole lot of time doing this because we have lots to go through. But he has been studying the book of Revelation for a long time, and he has studied thousands of various books and interviews and articles and whatnot. He has managed to put together what this wormwood thing means and how it fits with prophecy. And he studied a gentleman by the name of Dr. Jason Rand, and he put his work together too. And this has to do with facing numerous crises, political upheaval, financial destabilization. The Revelation prophecies as they unfold are 100% accurate. And perhaps of any time in all of human or civilization's history, we are facing something that could cause the total devastation of civilization's existence. But this is stuff we need to go through step by step, and Gil has been generous enough to say, Gianni, I will come back on, and I will go through this with you slowly, you and your listeners. We'll do it step by step. We'll talk about each judgment. So he's a former Vietnam helicopter pilot. He's had a lifelong passion in figuring out how everything is put together, and that means the book of Revelation as well. And that's from science to the Bible, and he graduated from Cal State Fullerton with a degree in psychology and attended the University of Oklahoma, where he studied descriptive linguistics, followed by research in Bible and prophecy, and especially, as I mentioned several times, his expertise in the book of Revelation. He began to understand these patterns of unity energy systems and free energy anti-gravity systems with an emphasis on Planet X effect on humanity. So having said all of that, Gil, welcome.
Grandma!
And I'm loving it, Gil. I'm loving it.
Oh, they're a lot of fun when they're little.
Yeah, do you have some?
Four.
Really?
Four grandchildren. Five kids, four grandchildren.
That's great. What are their age ranges?
You'd have to ask my wife. You know, women keep track of that stuff. Grandpas just want to play with them, you know. You do know there is a difference between being male and female?
Yeah, I kind of got that idea when
you
I
sort
had
of figured that out. Yeah. Okay. So if you want to know ages, dress sizes, pant sizes, shirt sizes, you know, how are these mittens big enough? You know, those kinds of, you have to ask a woman.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. If you ask a grandpa, he just wants to pick them up, throw them around, you know. You know, get down on the rug and have wrestle time or sit and have, you know, tickle time, story time, you know, all the, you know, the fun stuff. Grandpas don't like to have to remember all that stuff. That's for women.
Well, you know what? I couldn't agree with you more. My husband, you know, we have this little granddaughter who is like 5 days old, and he's like very gentle with her. And he's like, as soon as she cries and stuff, he hands her to me or my daughter or my son-in-law. But the five-month-old grandson, he's like on the floor playing choo-choo and pushing the kid around and, you know, all of these different things.
Well, sure, you got to have wrestle time, tickle time, hold time, story time, you know, all the fun stuff when they're rugrats. When they become teenagers, they don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, well, my daughters were like that, too, so I happen to agree with you.
So, congratulations, anyway.
Well, thank you, Gil. I appreciate that. Listen, you wrote a dynamic book, and I don't say that a lot about all of my guests. I mean, some guests have really good books, and some have mediocre books, but your book is dynamic, and I think it is appropriate for our time because of everything that is going on in the world. And you made it really understandable in spite of the fact that you did get technical with Planet X, but that's okay. I have 3 degrees in science, and I handled that. And it's not a terribly long section that would throw anybody off. So,
well, I tried to keep it understandable, you know, because I like it simple and conceptual.
Yeah, and you did that. You did a great job with that. So the book, listeners, again, is The Millennium Prophecy. And I have to tell you this, Gil, is I had gone to the doctor's last week after you had been on my show the first time last week. And my nurse said, I saw your radio announcement where you having Mr. Erickson on. I says, yes. And she said to me, do you know that I bought his book before I even knew he was going to be on your radio show? Because everybody told me what a great book it is. I didn't even have to persuade her. She already bought it.
So, well, I didn't write it as a fiction or as a story. I wrote it just, you know, straight exposition to explain things.
Right, but and you did when, a great
when you
job.
Look at, yeah, when you look at the revelation a certain way and you fill in some of these blank spots, all of a sudden the revelation makes very good sense. It really does. But if you don't know how to kind of handle some of the, you know, descriptive language and whatnot, it just seems so opaque. But there are some keys to it. There's some ways to approach it. And when you do it that way, and you approach it in its consecutive linear order, then it does. It really makes a lot more sense. And suddenly the revelation gives you, you know, like a shopping list of the things that are coming our way. It tells you ahead of time when they will come and the order that they'll be presenting themselves. It's really very impressive.
Well, you know, and I while we're talking about that, I wanted to share something with you that I found, I guess, maybe a bit frightening. And that was yesterday I was listening to the 7 o'clock news on ABC. They were interviewing two pastors under a hidden camera. And both of these pastors were practicing pastors, have been pastors 18, 20 years, maybe even more. And they said that they no longer believed in God, that when they went through the Bible and they studied the Bible in the seminary, they believed it. But when they got out and they started to study other books, and this didn't happen overnight now, this was over a period of time they started to study other books that were counter to the Bible, they said that the Bible didn't really make sense, that things could not have happened like the Bible said it would. And so their faith is gone, Gil, and yet they still have congregations that they're preaching to. And what makes somebody like that, those two pastors in particular, you know, wanting to go in and serve Christ and then find out later that what they believed was topsy-turvy? How does that happen? You've studied the Bible.
Well, part of it has to do with your ability to think and reason correctly. Part of it has to do with human character. Part of it has to do with what kind of credence you give to the sources that you are considering. In other words, if somebody comes along with some brand new pet theory and, God doesn't exist because blah, 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 rah, 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 and sis, boom, boss. That's the list. So we start with blah, blah, blah. Oh, boy, I never thought about that. And then there's, rah, rah, rah. Oh, geez, I never thought about that either. And then there's sis, boom, bah. Oh, that does it for me. I'm not going to be a believer anymore. So if you lend credence to things that sometimes appear to make sense until you look a little deeper, you can get hooked. And the other part, too, is just, the Christian life really is a test of patience. And that really just cuts across the grain of a lot of people's character. They don't like that daily grind. They don't like the setbacks. They don't like the tests of patience and, so on, that just are part of the real world life. They just don't like that stuff. But life is that way. It does grind you down. It does give you a hard time. There is maintenance that has to be done constantly, relentlessly. And, the pastoral ministry is probably one of the most frustrating, next to being a mayor of a city or something. Because you have, parishioners who don't do very well in their spiritual life. They're constantly beset by sin. They're constantly beset by, trapped by this, that, or the other. There's always something waiting to trap or hurt you spiritually. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the opposition's reign of deception is good. Whatever else he is or is not, Lucifer, Satan, he is intelligent. He's really quite shrewd. And he does understand human nature. And since we already have a fallen nature, God is redeeming us out of our fallen condition. God starts where we are, fallen. And he changes our eternal destiny. According to Colossians 1, he translates us from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of his beloved Son. But, that process of growth is just tough. And there are going to be some casualties along the way. There will be people who don't make it. They try, they look at it, they wrestle with it, and they just finally throw up their hands. They don't have the character substance that can relate to the problems that the Lord does present in real life, in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So life can be tough. It can be challenging. It doesn't get better or easier. You just get older and you slow down. You don't have the energy to keep up anymore.
Yeah, that's kind of sad, isn't it? I mean, these are the guys who are supposed to be leading their flock. And here they are, they're misleading their flock.
Well, not necessarily. They may be preaching gospel from the pulpit, but here's the point. Did you notice that it is the how the media wants to suck up to this kind of thing? That's the telling thing. See, there's a non-believer behind that camera. There's a non-believer behind the editing. There's a non-believer who sent the reporters out to go do the interview. There's some non-belief somewhere, and any time they can stick it to the Christians, do it. And it's relentless.
Yeah.
It just keeps going on and on and on. You can expect the secular media to behave that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real telling thing. Find somebody. And if you can't find somebody who really is, then make up somebody. Have somebody who's, knowledgeable about it and claim that he's a pastor, stick him behind a screen so nobody knows who he is. Disguise his voice a little bit, and, it sounds like he knows what he's doing, and you can pretend that you have a pastor who's fallen. Okay? So
mm-hmm.
It may not even have been a true story, but, they are presenting it as if it is. And you get that kind of stuff from the media as well. If they can't give you the truth, well, then they'll, serve up whatever it is their agenda and propaganda. What their agenda drives them to do will sometimes come out more as propaganda than anything else. So it may not even have been a true interview. Might have been staged.
That's possible. But I do know that the media is pretty much anti-Christian. I think the world is pretty much anti-Christian these days, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But you could be right about that. But
mm-hmm.
all the same, it is a trial, isn't it? I mean, you have to take the leap of faith and hope it's right. And if it's not, you didn't lose anything. If you're right, you gained everything.
Well, I would take the opposing view. I kind of like the rationalist approach, Pascal.
Yeah.
In Pascal's wager, if I'm right, I gain everything. If I'm wrong, I don't really lose much. In other words, I'm going to give up, drunkenness or whoring around or catching strange diseases or whatever. Okay, so I'll give that up. I can live a normal life. I can be healthy. I can do creative things. So, you know, Pascal certainly was quite creative as a mathematician and physicist. But the point was that, you know, by giving up some of these more, you know, personally destructive kinds of behaviors and participations, I can end up with, I can still have a, you know, a very successful and happy life. But the point is, as a believer, not only can I have a, you know, a happy life or a life that makes some sense, at least that has meaning to it, but then I have eternal life to look forward to. For the person who has no hope for eternity, to them, death is kind of the end of it all, at least from what they can tell. They have no idea what it is that's going to confront them on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So faith is not an irrational kind of thing. It's not truly a leap of faith. Leap of faith implies I'm going to jump off the cliff. And that's not what you're doing. You're piecing things together, you know, accurately, patiently. It can be a very rational thing. There have been some extremely rational people who have decided that the life of faith makes a great deal of sense. I mean, you have guys like, well, let's pick a few. Jewish would be Einstein, Herr Einstein. You know, he didn't believe in God as we do, but more like Spinoza, I guess. But, you know, he came to the conclusion that there has to be a creator behind all of this order. Too much order. You don't get order in the natural world. It tends toward disorder. It's called entropy. He was aware of that as a physicist. René Descartes, mathematician. Pascal, mathematician and physicist. Sir Isaac Newton. He started out as a mathematician and physicist and then ended up becoming a theologian. Now, isn't that interesting? He thought his life work was more important as a theologian than as a mathematician and physicist. It's pretty good when you can come up with things like inventing calculus and, you know, discovering all sorts of stuff and describing how, you know, the language of science for the future. And between, you know, you have people like that, high-caliber people that are Christian and or, you know, at least theistic. It's not a stupid thing. There's some extremely intelligent people who are very much believers that there has to be a divine creator. There has to be a mind and some will somewhere to create all of this, to make all of this stuff happen. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is James Clerk Maxwell in the 1860s.
Yeah.
Whoa. Brilliant, brilliant mind. I mean, this guy wrote the physics for magnetism, and 150 years later, we're still going back to his formulas and following them because he hit the nail on the head. Brilliant mind. And very, very committed Christian. It's just, you know, sort of a sad thing that he didn't live very long. What he would have produced if he just had lived longer. But he got sick and he died in his 40s. Very sad. But also, you know, a deeply, deeply committed Christian. So there are brilliant, brilliant minds. Very brilliant people. Very successful at what they do in the world of science and mathematics and so on. Who are very rational and also believe that there is indeed a divine creator. So, you know, faith isn't always an irrational thing. I kind of would like to take, pardon me, but I like to take the opposite tack on that one, okay?
Sometimes you're a real devil's advocate. I know that.
Yeah, I know.
Like
right? Sometimes, you know, it isn't just an irrational thing to have faith, you know? Some of the big questions can't be answered by science alone. Science is sort of groping in the dark half the time. And, you know, they stumble and they fumble and they flub up. And they don't always get it right on the first round. You know, it may take them a few rounds before they get it right. And paradigms keep shifting on them. So, you know, science, by, you know, in and of itself, as a inductive and deductive process, is not pure 100%, you know, hit the nail on the head every time.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the really big questions, who are we, why are we here, where do we come from, what's going on, these rather difficult philosophical questions can't be answered by science. Say, the world by wisdom knew not God. Okay?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there aren't some very wise people who've come to the conclusion God does indeed exist. There's very good reason, teleological reason, for believing that God exists and he knows what he's doing. He's actually very good at what he does. Extremely so.
But didn't Hawking just come out and contradict himself when he once said there was a grand design, meaning God, and recent book came out and said there was no grand design, it was all haphazard? So, I mean, he reversed his position.
So, he's human.
And on that note, we have to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about Revelation. Don't go far, listeners. You don't want to miss this show. And as you know, I have Mr. Gilbert Erickson on, and we got on, kind of sidestepped our question just a bit, talking about faith and, you know, people who supposedly believed in a God at one time and changed their mind. But that was just kind of something I wanted to share with Gil. But we really want to talk about his book, The Millennium Prophecy, and what he has written in there about Revelation in terms of not only what is going to unfold with the breaking of each seal, but also, and equally important, is where does Wormwood or Planet X or Nibiru or the brown dwarf star fit into all of this, as apparently NASA is very much aware of this gigantic star out there or planet or whatever body it is, asteroid, comet. And they are not being level honest with us at all about it. But Gil is here to set us straight. So, Gil, you know, your book goes through the breaking of each seal, and I would like to do that. But if you wanted to give a kind of a prologue before we do start with number one, you're free to do that.
Okay. You want to go through the six seals? Is that what you want to do?
Yeah, I would like to do that because both you and I would think the majority of my listeners, who many of them are Christians, understand that Revelation talks about these judgments. And as you so clearly pointed out, even in my last show, that these judgments are like signposts. The Lord is telling us what is going to happen before he comes. So would that be a proper way to say that?
Yes, I suppose it would. You don't want to get into the background in terms of what the drivers are. You just want to talk about the Revelation, chapter 6.
Well, I mean, how would you like to do it? We have an hour and a half, and, you know, we eat up probably 5 minutes every half hour for commercials. So you tell me what you would like to do.
All right, let's do it this way. One of the problems that I ran into when I got into the study of the Revelation proper, you know, pretty much as a solo effort, it struck me that the book was in the correct linear order as given. And I had problems, too, with the opening verses in chapter 7. They really just bugged me no end. And eventually what came out of that, I was attempting to try to get at it from, you know, studying correlation of the word rather than comparing commentaries. So then after I went back and checked some, just a little bit on the commentaries, an interesting thing fell out. What I had concluded was that the Revelation was, in fact, in pretty much in very linear, strict, sequential linear order. And it isn't until you get to chapter 11 that you have, you know, the death of the two witnesses, but there's nothing spoken about the arrival of the two witnesses that you have to actually do any arithmetic to figure anything out. So you can take it in its linear order. It also tracks with the linear order as described for the Temple Mount Discourse in the Synoptic Gospels. They both tend to track pretty much straight up, straight linear order. It was as if the Lord Jesus in the Temple Mount Discourse was reading off of a list. It's just a recitation list. And it didn't matter whether it was, you know, Matthew, Mark, or Luke, with one verse exception in Luke, or the Revelation, the long version to John, you know, probably could have taken days to write down. Okay. So the problem then is that if the book is in linear order, the linear order, sequential order, places interpretive constraints on what you can do. Okay? Just following the linear order as the Lord Jesus gave it places some interpretive constraints. There are a lot of people who are very uncomfortable with the idea of a linear order, so they take chapter 6 with the breaking of the seals and they spread that all over the entire book, you know. Well, that's not the correct way to interpret the Revelation. The problem is that the Book of Judgments and worldwide title rights, rulership rights, that the Lord that God the Father hands to the Lord Jesus in chapter 5 is still closed. The book is sealed up. It isn't until that book is opened and the Lord reads off the judgments and so on, that the progress of real judgment can begin. And historically, the church has not dealt with that very well. So what you had was, I think where the church got steered a little bit down a blind alley was a very well-meaning, very well-intentioned, and very widely read and studied evangelist from the 1900s, Harry Ironside. Now, Ironside was a famous evangelist from out here in the L.A. area. All he ever wanted to do was preach and teach. He was very good at it. Very enthusiastic man. Powerful preacher, powerful minister, powerful teacher. I think he was even, the University of Chicago, or one of the schools of theology in Chicago area for a while. Mm-hmm. And he died in New Zealand in harness, preaching, evangelistic services down in New Zealand. He's buried there. But Harry Ironside noted that the word, the term, church, C-H-U-R-C-H, church, does not appear in the Revelation after chapter 3, which is correct. The word or the term, church, does not appear in the Revelation after chapter 3. So he deduced, well, then that means that in chapter 4, because the scene switches to heaven, that must be where the church is. And unfortunately, he missed it on that one.
Okay.
That was a big mistake. Now, Hal Lindsey and some of these others, guys who are real heroes to me, you know, a lot of them follow that. This has almost become dogma. Certainly, a place that they tend to dig their heels in the Christian seminaries. This is what they teach the pastors, that the church has been removed because it no longer appears, the word does not appear in Revelation after chapter 3. Well, not true. This has led then to some other confusion about the problem of pre-trib, mid-trib, post-trib, so forth, rapture of the church, because the church was promised that it wouldn't have to go through judgments, according to Paul's testimony in Thessalonians and also 1 Corinthians 15. But he was correct that the term or the word church does not appear after chapter 3. Well, then where is the church? Answer, it's still right here on earth. You blew it out the shorts on that one. And mm-hmm. The place that we find it, still here on earth, in chapter 6, is the breaking of the fifth seal. There's the church is still here. Then that means the seals are not judgments, because we're promised we're going to have to go through the judgments. Okay, 1 Thessalonians 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. These things will not overtake you, and 2 Thessalonians 5. But the point is that we will not have to go through the judgments. And I wrestle with this. I don't know. I must have wrestled with this for several years to try to resolve these things: the problem of chapter 7, the problem of chapter 6, and the problem of the word church, and so on. I mean, I went round and round and round. And eventually, it dawned on me: okay, the issue is that if God says He's not going to judge his church, he might discipline us, but he won't judge the church, then the issue is that, these are not judgments. They are signposts. And all of a sudden, the lights went on. Well, if they're signposts, the church is indeed still here, because it shows up in chapter 5 that there's an awful lot of martyrs that are being created on earth. And they show up under the throne, in front of the throne, and they cry out, Lord, how long is this going on? This is terrible. How long are you going to keep this going? They just cry out. They're under the altar in front of God the Father. He said, just take it easy, rest a while. There's going to be a lot more of you coming in this way. It's going to get rough. Christians are going to be martyred on a more intense level. And the church loses about 200,000 believers every year now from murders and martyrdom.
Right. You're talking about Christian churches,
Christian church.
In general. Okay.
Believing Christian church. So the fifth seal event points toward the persecution of the Christian church as a sign. Okay? Now, because the revelation is in sequential linear order, then that was the fifth seal. Turns out the seals then, when Jesus breaks the seal in heaven, the scene switches back to earth and something unfolds on earth. then back to heaven, break a seal, back to earth, an event happens. Back to heaven,
okay.
Break a seal, and so on. And so the Christian church is still here in chapter six in the form of the fifth seal warning event, and the martyrs show up in front of God's throne. Okay? Now, you were going to ask a question?
I was going to say, I want to do these one by one. I know you're talking about the fifth seal, but I would like to go through them one by one, Gil, so that
right.
You know we understand this when we get to the end of this.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to do is lay that foundation now. Okay, so the church is still here. The chapter 6 list of seal-breaking events, the six seals, the breaking of the six seals in sequential order, are not judgments. They are signposts. The Lord Jesus gives us six different things or sets of things that we can look at in a specific order, and they go from the general to the progressively more specific. Okay? Now we're going to deal with seals. Okay?
Okay.
Let's deal with that. All right, Revelation 6:1. Then I saw the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, come on, go look at this. So the Lamb breaks a seal. What do we see? 6:2. I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow. And a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Jesus comments that between the time of his departure and the time of his return, that you're going to see wars and rumors of wars and so forth. He confirms that also in the Gospels, Matthew 24:6. Mark 13, and Luke 21. So the first seal is that you're going to see this problem of wars and rumors of wars. Now, in the 20th century, an interesting thing happened. Suddenly you had a war in every generation. I thought, well, that's interesting. So when that started happening, you saw that you see these conquests back and forth and back and forth. And now it increases in intensity so that there's one in every generation. It's, whoa. Okay, so that was getting a little bit more serious. Then the second event. Now we go back to heaven. He broke his second seal. Okay, we go and take a look. 6:4. Another red horse went out, and to him who sat it was granted to take peace from the earth, that men would slay one another. A great sword was given to him. Okay. I describe this in the book. I say what you have is a worldwide increase in capital murder, personal anger, ethnic rivalry, personal and community unrest. And to my mind, that it looked to me like the second seal was broken and the events began to play out back and started in very intensely in 1994 when you had this tremendous ethnic violence that erupted between the Tutsi and the Hutu people down in Burundi and Rwanda. By the time that was finished, there was 800,000 dead people just from tribal warfare and hatred, bitterness. Well, two generations prior, sometimes they were getting along as friends. All of a sudden, now they couldn't. And then it continued. It didn't stop there. Then it shifted. You had wars, rivalries, homicides, and so forth in East Timor and Indonesia. Then it moved to Africa and Chechnya and the Philippines. It just went on and on and on from there. Plus, you had the shootings in the United States, random, all these crazy guys going postal and shooting, shooting up schools and all the rest of it. I thought, oh boy, power to take peace from the earth. And it was in the order, again, the sequential order that the Revelation gave us. That was the second thing to look for. We move to the third seal. He breaks the third seal, verse 5. The description starts, what do we see? Verse 6. A quart of wheat for a denarius, three quarts of barley for a denarius, but do not harm the oil and the wine. So we get as selective shortages for cereal grains, wheat and barley, but it doesn't affect olive oil or grape production, wine production. Well, that's interesting. Now it's getting very specific. Okay? You see the progress?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think it was a couple of years ago. The wheat futures on the Minneapolis Exchange, which most people don't pay much attention to it, went from $3 or $4, I think, a bushel. What was it? Four something a bushel. and just exploded in a very short period of time to something like over $25 a bushel. Just exploded. I mean, it's just pandemonium in the wheat market. And then there were shortages of barley. People who were in the, you know, Campbell's soup and some of the others use a lot of pearl barley for soups, and people who are in the chicken feed business use a lot of barley for chicken feed, and people who are in the beer brewing business were having trouble finding pearl barley so they could brew beer or make that chicken, you know, blend up chicken feed or cook up soups for canned soup. So people who had, you know, real use for barley were having trouble finding it. Again, right in order. Now, one of the things I should mention about these seals is that once a seal is broken, it continues to play out after that. It doesn't stop. So now you had the first seal, the second seal, and the third seal were playing out. And they would just roll on in waves. Suddenly you'd have more people running postal, and then you'd have suddenly a shortage of grain. Or then it would go back to, well, so-and-so invaded such-and-such. And then back to, you know, price of grain might go down, then price of grain might go up, and so on. So they keep playing out. You follow? So
yes.
Now we have three seals that had broken.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in the order, again, they're in the specific order as given by the Lord Jesus.
But with these seals, were there not like a white horse, a red horse, a black horse? Weren't those part of these seals?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the red horse. The red horse was the second seal.
Right.
The white horse was the first seal.
Okay, so when you say like white horse, red horse, black horse, what's the significance? Is some of them are death, some are famine? I mean, should we be aware of that? I would like to be aware of that.
You wind up in an interpretive alley there. You want to be kind of careful. What he's doing is he's just giving you labels. A white horse, he who sat ahead of bow. A crown was given to him, and he went out conquering to conquer. Okay, so that's the first seal. So you have conquest, wars, rumors of wars, invasions, kingdom against kingdom, nation against nation, on and on and on. But in the 20th century, it's in every generation. Here comes another war. Here comes another war. Here comes another war. First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam. And, you know, they're getting ready to, now we just barely turned the first of the millennium, and now they want to go out and have war with Iran because they got nothing else better to do. Okay, so it just keeps playing out. You follow? So the label then is the white horse for conquest. Then the second seal is broken. That's the red horse. And, you know, it's a symbol of unrest. Ethnic unrest, murder, personal revenge, anger, community unrest. Okay, then the third seal. That's a black horse. And things get a little more dark here because it's not a food to eat. It prices when it finally hits at its peak. A quart of wheat for a denarius, 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. A denarius back in the day was a day's wage. Roman coin, 1 day's wage. Well, a quart of wheat is enough to make a flour to make about 2, maybe 3 loaves of bread. That's it. 2 big loaves and 3 smaller loaves. 3 quarts of barley would be good enough to make a pretty good pot of soup, big pot. But, you know, a whole day's wage for that? So it's going to take all your daily wages just to buy your food. So food shortage is coming. But it's selective. It particularly calls out wheat, which is going to hit the bread market like crazy, you know, and pizza and all the others, people who make things out of wheat. And then it calls out barley, and again, there's specific markets that use those commodities. But olive oil and wine, and I assume it's olive oil and wine, because they're tied together, are exempted. So again, it gives you a specific set of things to look for. You follow? And the label that he puts on that is black horse. Just getting, you know, things aren't looking good. They're getting worse. Starts out white, and I figure it's normal. Politics, yippee. Oh, shoot, red horse. Now it gets to be, you know, bloody murder. Oh, shoot, black horse. Now we've got famines, problems. Now it could be famines where people have, you know, trying to grow wheat and they don't get enough rain or whatever. It could be fires like they had in the Soviet Union. You know, it could be anything. Upset weather. And wormwood has a way of doing that. It can cause a lot of grief in the weather. Okay, so he puts the label, black horse. The guy who's got the black horse and... And here comes the cereal grain shortage. So to me, it's just a label. And as I don't try to come up with some deep, dark, esoteric interpretation for it, You follow?
Yeah, I do. But I know that a lot of the listeners know some of these seals by their names. Mm-hmm. And I like for them to make that mental connection that though you don't want to do that, and I understand that, for them it's important that because when they read the Bible, they certainly read these things. You know, whether it's the white horse, the pale horse, the souls under the altar.
Right. What you need to be paying attention to, very carefully, you need to be paying attention to the problem of what is being described. Jesus breaks the seal. That's the seal, you know, that's an event that happens in heaven. And it's like he's pointing. Okay, I break this seal. And he points back to the earth, and then you see something. Okay? And this goes on over and over and over again. Six times he does this, right? So there's a list of events that are presented to us in order. We can't see him break the seal, but we see a specific set of things work out in a specific order here on earth, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the white horse, the red horse, the black horse. Now we come to the fourth seal event, and that's the ashen horse. Okay, now here he gives an odd description. He says authority was given to him over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine, with pestilence, and the wild beasts of the earth. And I wrestle with this and wrestle with this and wrestle with this. And one day I'm sitting there studying the time zone chart of the earth, how they divvy up the time zones of the world. And it's pretty gerrymandered. It's a mess. But looking at the time zone chart of the world, and what I notice is that if you take it from GMT, I think it's heading east from Greenwich, you know, Greenwich Mean Time, and you go east six time zones because there's 24 in a, you know, 24 time zones for the 24-hour revolution of the Earth. And if you go east, it lands on that part of the world where we're seeing this tremendous amount of upset. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Sudan, Ethiopia, Africa, Arabia, the Middle East, India, Chechnya, Russia, and so on. So you just move back from about GMT, I think it's plus one, backwards, and it takes you all the way to China, and it lands you in this Eurasian chunk of the world where there is so much of these problems. And it says that this guy, whoever it is that's riding the ashen horse, and he said, he who sat on it had the name of death. And Hades followed after him, collecting the souls, you know. Authority was given to him over a fourth of the earth. Now, that's how I divvied it up. I mean, there's other people who would want to cut the world up some other way, you know, slice it in quarters or something. And that's okay if that's how you want to interpret it. But this is the one that struck me, that there is so much negative activity that happens in these time zones, that I'm saying, geez, it is exactly what he said. It is a fourth of the earth when you slice it up that way. And if you just take orange slices from pole to pole for the time zones, and you take those six, take a quarter of them, heading from, you know, Greenwich Mean backwards, and boy, there is what exactly was described. Problems with, war and famine, pestilence. And later, I'm sure we're going to see more of the stuff with wild beasts causing troubles. We've already had troubles with SARS, you know, with bird flu and whatnot. So, you know, it's just been a mess. And this, for some reason, this particular section of the world seems to be suffering from it. But isn't it just uncanny that the Revelation called that out 2,000 years back?
Yeah.
I find that very, very intriguing, okay? Now, again, could I be wrong in that it's some other way you need to divide the earth up or something? Yes, I could be. But that was the one that struck me as I was trying to harmonize this with what was happening, okay?
Okay.
Anyway, so that's your ashen horse. That's the label for the ashen horse. That takes care of the four horsemen. And then we move on to the next one, the fifth seal.
That's the one with the souls under the altar, right?
That's right. Now, the fifth seal doesn't point to an event on earth. It points to an event in heaven. You broke the fifth seal, and I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God, because of the testimony which they had maintained. They cried out to the Lord. with a loud voice, Oh Lord, how long are you going to do this? Holy and true, how long will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood for those on the, you know, who dwell on the earth who've done this to us? There was given to each of them a white robe. They told that they should rest a little while. They're actually going to be more martyrs, okay? So just take it easy. This, you're just the early arrivals. Eventually the Lord's going to collect the entire church. But the first round coming in here, you know, is the martyrs. And they enter right in front of the throne room of God himself, right there under the altar, real close to God the Father. And he says, okay, you know, just watch what happens now. There's more of this stuff has to happen. We've got it all under control. But their souls are secure in the hands of God the Father, creator of heaven and earth. And he wants them right there where he can see them. They've paid a blood price to believe in him. Okay? That counts mm-hmm. for something in the mind of God the Father. That's why he has them gathered there, right in front of him. He wants to see them. And if nothing grabs you, that should. He, God the Father, wants to see you. You pay a blood price, you're martyred for your faith. God the Father wants to look you in the eye. Okay? That kind of faith impresses God the Father, the creator of heaven and earth. Now, okay, we can't see that they're gathered as souls under the altar in front of the throne of God the Father, but it does tell us that there is martyrdom still going on of the believers. So the Christian church is still here. God is using the persecution of the Christian church as a signpost, along with these other signposts we've just read, other seal warning events. And as this erupts and it gets more intense, this is a sign. Okay, now, I think it was 2008, 2009, when all of a sudden, just like out of nowhere, there started to be massive persecution of the Christians in India, the Hindus. Just suddenly, you know, and they're more, tend to be more passive, pacific kinds of people, trying to get along with others, you know. And all mm-hmm. of a sudden they turned militant. They started running around slaughtering and killing Christians, burning down whole villages of Christian, you know, Christian communities. Burning the houses, burning the churches, murdering the people. Just out of nowhere. So the fifth seal event, it struck me that the fifth seal had been loosed.
All right, we're going to take a break and pick up right from there. So hang on, Gil. Listeners, don't go far. We're coming right back here.